Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Black Lives Matter. What does it mean? It's the focus of the latest interview in a series by UK historian Gerald Smith.
It is my pleasure to welcome Dr. Sandra E. Weisinger, Associate Professor of Sociology at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville, where she is also the director of the graduate program. Professor Weisinger is the recipient of the Emerson Teaching Award and the Teaching Excellence Award from Southern Illinois University of Edwardsville. She is the co-editor of Law Enforcement in the Age of Black Lives Matter, Policing Black and Brown Bodies, and she's also the co-editor of Violence Against Black Bodies, an Intersectional Analysis of How Black Lives Continue to Matter. Dr. Weisinger, welcome to this radio segment on racial justice in Kentucky and America.
Thank you so much for having me.
One of the courses that you teach there at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville, is titled Black Lives Matter. Please begin by defining the Black Lives Matter movement. And following that, would you also share with us the course objectives for that particular class?
This is a class that came to me as I was writing the anthologies you had mentioned and thinking about what are ways that we can do good work of making sure our students understand the time at hand. Now, I will admit to you, I see Black Lives Mattering as a movement as part of something that is larger, a larger historical movement that has been with us in the United States since we saw our first forms of resistance. So I think Nat Turner's Rebellion is the start of some version of Black Lives Mattering. I also think that any movement that acknowledges justice for minoritized people, that fits in here. So Pan-African movement, Black is Beautiful as a movement, liberation sociology and theology as movements, certainly the civil rights movement. But I think of these as being part of the same thing. Our goal is always justice and equity. Black Lives Matter, though, as we know it today, well, that was started by two sisters from out west. This was her way of saying, even if these court systems, they allow for these murders to go without persecution, you and I know Black Lives Matter. They've always mattered. So we keep having to have this conversation. So when I think of Black Lives Matter, it's historical. It is entrenched into the very history and fabric of America. Concerning the course objectives, I think it's very important that my students recognize that Black Lives Mattering, that's American. It is a fight to make America great in the most significant sense of it. By understanding that Black Lives Matters and how that is a very American story, that allows us to really make it part of the standard for understanding American history. It's not just Black history, it is American history. We cannot understand our country until we are able to wrap our heads around all the different ethnic groups and racial groups that make this country what it is today. And in teaching, I also want to explain why Black Lives Matter exists as the movement it is today. And I want to make sure that my students are empowered so that they can go forth and teach others. It's not enough just to teach in the classroom. It's got to reach outside. And in doing that, this is how we make citizens who are able to examine current inequalities and make choices to alleviate those inequalities.
Let's talk about your book that you co-edited with Dr. Dwayne Mack, The Law Enforcement in the Age of Black Lives Matter. Why did you decide to prepare this anthology?
You know, we couldn't help but to do it. It had to happen. For us, it was a logical anthology to do following our first anthology together, our first text together, Violence Against Black Bodies. What readers would find in reading The Law Enforcement in the Age of Black Lives Matters is a more specific look at policing practices. In addition to what police officers need, I had the pleasure of doing some follow-up work for the Ferguson Commission, forward through Ferguson, and looking specifically at what policies we were trying to implement after the untimely death of Mike Brown, which of those policies actually were implemented and which were not implemented. And so for us, it was very, very important to look at, well, do the police need more mental health care? Do they need more community collaboration? But on the other side of that, we also address what the criminalization of migrants, of Latinx, Latino, Latina folks, what that criminalization looks like, specifically when they enter ICE facilities and that threat of rape by those who are supposed to be guarding and treating these people as humans. We also certainly look at the psychological effects of policing on Black and Brown bodies. So there's two different areas we look at: what it takes for officers to do this job and what it takes for us to have a more equitable system so that people are not traumatized by policing.
What did you actually learn from working on that book about policing in America?
Well, it's so interesting. The policing book is really very helpful because I had to take a step back as someone who lives in the St. Louis area. I had, of course, been in the midst of the Ferguson protest, and I certainly had been teaching students and having conversations on campus about what policing meant, it's good, it's bad, and what we could do as citizens to encourage policing practices that were not dehumanizing. And so for me, in learning and doing this book, my goodness, the history. We've been circling around and around again for generations. So that's what I learned. Even as we change as a society, if we don't heal, we just replace. We replace, we replace, we do it again and again.
It's been 2 years since that book was published. And since then, of course, this year, our nation has witnessed the tragic deaths of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. And, of course, their deaths have elevated the protests and discussions on police brutality. With that being said, what chapters would you add in a second edition?
That question is so troubling, Gerald, because you don't want to have to keep doing this work. The fact that I do feel a need to even have a second edition, well, it's troubling, certainly. If we were to add on to this, I think we definitely need to speak to what it means to police trans lives in the U.S. and perhaps worldwide. I think of that because of Tony McDade of Florida. We don't know if he had a gun, but he certainly was shot dead. Or Leyland Polanco of New York. This is a person who died while in police custody. And, you know, we think it was because of an underlying seizure, but we just don't know. We don't know, and we have to keep having these conversations. Were their deaths untimely and at fault because of police, or were their deaths untimely and they would have occurred even without police interaction? We don't have enough information, but here's what we do know. Black lives are inclusive of trans lives. So that's a conversation we need to have. I think also a conversation that needs to occur is how we commodify Black Lives Matter and we commodify our back the blue or support of policing. This isn't necessarily something that needs to be sold or put on stickers. This isn't something that should be a slogan for those who are participating in Black exit from the Democratic Party. This shouldn't be something that becomes a statement for companies and institutions, Black Lives Matter. No, it really should be work that is done. So that would be a chapter to add. And I think a last chapter, we've heard so many calls for defunding the police. And I think that is a conversation that needs to be explored, but explored in a way that is not as polarizing as some of the conversations I have heard so far. Folks need to listen to this call which really is at the core of the law enforcement book, that we make sure that we have social services available, that we make sure that we have de-escalation trainings available to police, all of those things that are at the core of the law enforcement book. I feel like we need to have another standout chapter that just says, this is what defunding the police actually means. Certainly, it does not mean get rid of the police. It means let's provide resources in ways that make our communities safer, not make us more fearful, or allow us to be back in the courts having the same conversations again and again.
What do you think about efforts to monitor police discipline?
Well, it's like every institution, isn't it? You know, I work in higher ed. Certainly, I appreciate the fact that my courses are evaluated, that my work is monitored. And I think that has to occur in any discipline, any profession you are in. And so when it comes to body cameras, they keep those police safe as well as keep anyone who is interacting with them safe, because that allows us to understand what's occurring. And I have yet to find an officer who wasn't in support of that when they look at what's happening in the society today, where folks are genuinely concerned and afraid. These police have a job to do. They know it. It's a difficult job. And anything that makes that job safer, easier, and more effective, I found that folks that I tend to interact with in terms of police and in terms of society members, they're for that.
Are there any closing comments or observations you'd like to make at this time?
I think that sometimes when we're talking about policing, when we're talking about Black Lives Mattering, there are challenges. And we need to be aware of those challenges and try to navigate around them. We are not encouraging divisiveness. We are not encouraging division. What these texts allow us to do is see America and American history as is, not as we want it to be. So when we think about challenges to having these conversations, we have to be brave and willing to talk about safety threats to those who are willing to have these conversations. I think about George Yancey and the blowback he got for publishing about white fragility in the New York Times. And I think about Joe Fagan, who is a white man who has, throughout his career, been willing to talk about racism and the blowback he has also gotten for doing such. So as a last comment from me, if we're going to do this work, and if Black Lives Matters is something that become something of our history, but not a movement that we move into constantly in the present. If that's what we want, if those are our goals, we've got to get used to talking about race, racism, white privilege, and holding all of us into having some form of accountability.
Thank you so much, Dr. Sandra Weisinger, and for your work and for your knowledge and for the vision and foresight that you have as we continue to grapple with this very challenging and disturbing topic of police brutality. You've been listening to my interview with Dr. Sandra E. Weisinger, Associate Professor of Sociology at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville, and we've discussed her book, Law Enforcement in the Age of Black Lives Matter. Again, thank you, Dr. Weisinger.
Thank you so much.
What was it like to be a decision maker at a hospital in the early, confusing days of the pandemic? The question is on Chris Begley's mind for this latest in his series, Future Tense.
Today on Future Tense, I welcome Dr. Philip Chang, MD, Chief Medical Officer for the University Hospitals Cleveland Medical Center, formerly the System Chief Medical Officer for University of Kentucky Healthcare and faculty in the Department of Surgery. Welcome, Dr. Chang. Thanks for joining us.
Chris, thank you for having me. As I told you on the phone, this is my radio station.
All right. Well, mine too. And we sure appreciate being able to contribute. This show is focused on the pandemic reality that we're living in, the post-pandemic world. And I guess I wanted to start out just by asking about how this all started for you. I know that for me, I first heard news stories about COVID-19 probably in January. But it wasn't really until March, just before the shutdowns, that I really had a sense of what was coming. I was curious about your process of realization as a medical professional tasked with dealing with this kind of thing.
You know, it's interesting for me. I will vividly remember rounding at UK hospital with my residents and getting the news on my phone. This was right around Chinese New Year. And news just came out that China has shut down the city of Wuhan. And this is about 3 days before Chinese New Year. Not being from China, I didn't quite get the scale. So I quickly looked up how big Wuhan is. And I realized it's larger than New York City. So I turned to my resident. I said, do you realize what China just did? They just shut down the equivalent of Manhattan and larger 2 days before Christmas. Nobody in, nobody out. That's when I realized that there is something very serious going on there. It wasn't until probably like most people when barbershops begin to close, my favorite gym began to shut down, when I realized the gravity of the situation. Obviously, a lot of the hospitals who are very prepared have already been thinking about this. But I don't think any of us were completely prepared for the panic it caused and the challenges that we would have with some of the medical supplies that we all by now are very familiar with.
And so was dealing with things like the PPE and the number of ventilators and all of that, was that something that was an initial concern for you?
You know, unfortunately, I transitioned between Lexington UK Healthcare to Cleveland exactly at the start of the pandemic. And I remember at the time having meetings with chief nurse and the infection control specialist at UK, and we were talking about, so this is probably end of February, what impact this would be if we translated the percentage number from China and brought it to Kentucky, how quickly it would overwhelm our ICU capacity if we didn't develop additional capacity. The only thing we did not calculate was that elective operations will slow down to such a pace that, knock on wood, it hasn't been a problem for most of the hospitals in Kentucky and for that matter in Ohio. But certainly some of the states are seeing a lot of these problems that we're talking about. Currently, Utah is having quite a bit of problem.
I guess with this new surge, those problems as bad as they've been at any time in the past for some of these places.
Yes, you're right. And that's even with us having much better knowledge of how to deal with these patients. You know, we all downloaded some of the protocol manual that's coming out of China and then later on Europe, all try to learn what they were doing. This is a very interesting phenomenon that I don't think any of us has ever done in our medical profession, which is that we are learning how to take care of a disease on social media. Now, we have to double check and make sure they're reputable by calling your friends and whatnot, look up their credentials. But we were learning literally Facebook postings from emergency room physicians in New Orleans who said, watch out for these things. These are the symptoms. This is what we're seeing. Some of them are later turned out not to be true, but the scarcity of reputable published material was an important factor early on.
I wondered about that. I was thinking about, you know, the kind of research you'd done before. And I know, for instance, you did some research into pneumonia related to ventilator use. And I wondered if any of that kind of stuff might have translated to things that were going on with COVID, or is it such a new situation that really you were starting from scratch?
I don't think any of us were starting from scratch. And you know, my background is trauma and critical care and do take care of these patients. I think we built on what we learned. And at UK, I have 100% of confidence of the care in the ICU that UK physicians provide, which we all employed what we call a lung protective ventilator strategy. So if a patient were to be on a ventilator, we use the minimal amount of pressure and force to achieve what the patient needs So it's a protective strategy. And I think we built on that. What's surprising about COVID is that it threw curveballs at us where we're seeing vascular problems that typical viral pneumonia or bacterial pneumonia doesn't do.
Well, after going through this now for several months, are there lessons from the pandemic that you've learned as a healthcare professional or as a hospital administrator that'll be useful going forward?
Yeah, I think we've learned a lot from this. When I started in Cleveland, like I said, early March, within about 10 days, we realized this was going to be a problem, and the whole system decides that we're going to activate the emergency response system, something called Hospital Incident Command Center. And literally is that you go to a room where you got lots of phones, you've got different officers, there's a public information officer, there's a planning person, there's a supply person, et cetera, and you sit down and deal with these issues day to day. In those days, it was particularly important to react to what seemed like changing guidelines nationally. But what we've learned is leverage telehealth, number one. Number two, and Chris, I want to stress that it's not anything new, but it's amplified. We have had telehealth, but what we're seeing is we can really take advantage of telehealth. So all of a sudden, UK and Cleveland, there's been some telehealth foundation. Nobody really wanted to use it because we all like to see our patients and touch our patients. But with this, that got amped up. The idea of using the command structure in times of emergency, we all got very good at it. The idea of sharing information and be transparent about how things get done, those all got critically important. I'll say the other thing is, and this is a little bit like some of the experience we had dealing with opioid. You know, when I really got involved, it was not at the forefront of it. But the idea that Kentucky Hospital Association, for instance, stepped up and worked with us how to reduce opioid misuse. There's a role for opioid, but the misuse is what we're tackling. Having a central system where people came together and came up with shared ideas and information. And similarly with this, the hospital association or the state government taking on that role is something that we need to continue to have.
One of the things that all of us are seeing and that's surprising to some of us, and I wonder how this affects you as a healthcare professional, is how the response to the pandemic has become politicized. I wondered, has that impacted your efforts or your strategies at all? Does that sort of thing make its way into the hospital?
Of course it does. I just read recently one of the hospital systems out in the Midwest took out a 2-page ad to say, please wear your masks. Most hospitals, such as I believe University of Kentucky and where I am now in Cleveland at UH, we have set up screeners and screening stations and enforcing masks. Early on in the pandemic, we used to make rounds every day and what I jokingly call mask rounds. And we go around the hospital and every person we see who doesn't have the mask fully on, half masked, you know, you got the hanger around the neck, the one with the nose picking out, and I would walk by and just gently tap on my own mask. And they know, and they just go, oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Or people who are out in the open eating for long periods of time. So I think the healthcare providers all understand. They just need that reminder. We're not used to it just yet. It unfortunately has become politicized, and it didn't need to be, in my opinion. I think there is healthcare and science, and we're just trying to follow the science.
Yeah. Well, thinking about the future, one of the things that many of us are concerned with is that with increasing population, with our incursions into wildlife habitats, it seems like the possibility for the emergence of these new zoonotic diseases, that is, diseases passing from animals to humans like we believe this disease did, that seems increasingly likely. And I wonder, is this just the first of many of these? Is this the start of some new normal?
Chris, I think we're already seeing it. It didn't quite reach our shore. I remember prepping Ebola at University of Kentucky with our infectious disease specialists. Some hospitals in Cleveland, they prep for SARS because it hit Canada. And so a little close for comfort. I think it's already happening. I hope we don't have another one like this in a long, long time. But I'm incredibly optimistic for our people, for this country, because we're going to grow from this. I believe what we're going to see is people are going to understand after experiencing this that if they have a cold, if they're under the weather, they might go to work with a mask on. And instead of being ridiculed, they might get some understanding nod that the person wearing the mask is doing it for the benefit of others around them. It's probably just a simple cold. But that's going to help us. Already we're seeing in South America, the seasonal flu has been significantly, and I mean, you know, 50, 100 times less than what they saw last year. And some postulate, and I believe it's because we're all washing our hands, we're all being mindful not to touch our nose, and we're all wearing masks and keeping a healthy distance. So I'm incredibly optimistic that we're actually going to emerge from this as a healthier country.
Well, Dr. Philip Chang, I want to thank you very much for taking time, and I know, of course, you're busy dealing with all of this stuff, taking time to talk with us about this here on Future Tense. Thank you very much.
Chris, my pleasure.
Coming up after the break, the fight against a terrible disease that is especially serious in eastern Kentucky, and we're not talking coronavirus. We'll have the details of a new podcast series about life in small towns and rural places. And Thanksgiving is a people magnet, but there's a pandemic. What to do? I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, and Kayla Combs provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and personal injuries. More information at 859-777-7000.
Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.org or on the WEKU mobile app. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-522-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
While COVID-19 is, of course, top of mind for so many of us these days, our day-to-day health is no less important. In particular, type 2 diabetes has long been a serious issue across Kentucky, and especially in eastern Kentucky. But type 2 is preventable. From the project Prevent Diabetes EKY, Parker Hobson has a story on how some eastern Kentuckians are making moves to stop diabetes before it starts, even with a worldwide pandemic going on.
The pandemic has, of course, changed life in massive, earth-moving ways for so many of us this year. But it's also had smaller, more everyday effects.
Actually, I had gained 5 pounds. I was about to die, but I got those 5 off, so all is good.
This is Mary Beth Castle of Johnson County, Kentucky. Mary Beth is a lifestyle coach for people trying to prevent type 2 diabetes. And a big part of her job involves working with people's eating habits and trying to help with weight loss. So the pandemic has hit home, literally.
You know, Corona's got us all in our homes, and I think that we're eating more and not getting as much activity as if we were, you know, going about our normal day.
Mary Beth leads the Johnson County Health Department's version of the National Diabetes Prevention Program, or DPP for short. The DPP is a lifestyle change program with the ultimate goal of helping people prevent type 2 diabetes. And Eastern Kentucky has rates of type 2 that are higher than the state and national average.
This is an area where diabetes is very prevalent, and unfortunately, it typically runs in families, and so a lot of people just have taken that for granted, that that's just something that's going to happen to them. But there are things that we can do to maybe prevent it or maybe prolong it?
Unchecked, type 2 diabetes can lead to serious health problems, including damaged eyesight and kidneys, the loss of feeling in parts of the body, and even the loss of limbs. And it also carries a large risk for cardiovascular disease, among other issues. But Mary Beth says there's a connection with the coronavirus, too.
We do know that there are underlying health conditions that can cause greater concern if you are positive for coronavirus. And, of course, diabetes is listed, heart disease, of course, high blood pressure, asthma, COPD, all of those underlying issues can cause lots of other health issues added to having the coronavirus as well.
So if you can prevent type 2 diabetes, you're also reducing your potential risk of more serious symptoms from COVID-19 if you were to happen to get it.
It's one of those things that you've got to take a hold of it. You can't let it decide what it's going to do for you.
Marilyn Morgan lives in Johnson County, and she's currently a participant in Mary Beth's DPP group. Marilyn has prediabetes, a condition which, basically, means your blood sugar is high enough that you're at real risk of getting type 2 diabetes soon, unless you can make some lifestyle changes. When she was first diagnosed with prediabetes, Marilyn knew about type 2 because her husband George had been dealing with it for years. But she said she herself wasn't showing any symptoms, apart from just fatigue.
I was a little bit in shock. You know, it's always fine in general when you're talking about somebody else, but when it comes about you, it's a whole different ballgame. It can be earth-shattering, but I was diagnosed in 2008, and I've kept it under control ever since.
And keeping prediabetes from becoming type 2 is exactly what the DPP is about. Mary Beth says there are two big things anybody can do to help their diabetes risk: changing what you eat and how much you move your body. This does mean some weight loss, but Mary Beth says losing just 5-7% of your weight can make a huge difference in preventing type 2. And so in the DPP, everyone gets their own weight loss goal, and then classes focus on things like healthy recipes, counting fat grams and calories, eating smaller portions, and finding ways to get exercise in. Normally, a group meets in person over the course of a year, but the pandemic meant these meetings had to go virtual, using Zoom, the video conferencing program. And while changing habits can always be tricky, especially around food, the pandemic has added some new wrinkles on top.
It concerns me, not that they're eating at home, which is a good thing, but maybe they're not eating as well and people are snacking more. And one of the things that they suggest through our program is not to keep snack foods out on your kitchen counter and to put them in a cabinet. And so I finally had to do that. I finally had to put all of the snack goodies in that cabinet. So if I get something out, then I'm making a conscious decision to go in there and get out whatever it is that I think I want. If you're going to keep something on your counter, let's go with fresh fruits, so that if you go in there and you think, oh, I want that cookie, I'll eat a banana instead.
And especially if you're spending more time at home these days, it can also be easy to just feel a little more lethargic and to be moving around less.
If you're sitting and you find yourself watching TV a lot, and I think a lot of elderly people have been watching a lot of news, which is not a good thing because it's so depressing, that when commercials come on, get up, you know, walk through the house, walk down the hallway, walk circles around in your living room. Do not sit in that chair all the time.
I've been eating at home a lot more. And so that way I can control the sugar that's in the food and the sodium that's in the food.
For Marilyn, the pandemic hasn't been all bad for her DPP goals, especially around food.
I'll make my own pizza crust so I can control the sugar in that. I've even gone as far as taking some of my mom's old recipes and converting those over to sugar-free.
Marilyn says the exercise side of the coin has been a little tricky, though. For the past year or so, she had been working out with a professional trainer, but that stopped with the pandemic. and so she's had to get a little more creative.
Well, I go over to the local community college and walk around their track, and the rest of the time it's just maybe running the vacuum or mopping the floors or just getting up and moving within the house. Just knowing you're going to have to turn into Mary Beth, how many minutes did you exercise and what your weight is, you try to stay on track to be motivated to get that accomplished. And even though we do it on Zoom now because of COVID, we still can talk and see each other and still have that camaraderie to it.
When somebody doesn't make it to the meeting, they're like, where is so-and-so? I mean, we kind of keep each other accountable, but we also have become friends and we're concerned about one another. And we are all smiles when we get on Zoom. We can't hug each other, but we get to see each other.
In total, over the past year, including her time with a trainer and then starting DPP.
So far, I've lost about 25 pounds. I've met my first goal, which was lose 7% of my weight. Now I'm on my second 7. So as long as you stay on top of it and keep a positive mind, then you can do anything.
People started seeing me out in public, and they say, wow, you look so, you know, what have you done? And I say, well, I'm on the diabetes prevention program. I'm just counting calories and counting fat grams.
Connie Godsey Duval lives in Cumberland County, Kentucky. She's also a DPP participant. She started the program last summer and says she lost about 25 pounds, and that's weight she's been able to keep off. Type 2 runs in her family, and she says preventing it also has a special urgency right now.
I even went back to the radio station. They have a Talk Around Town program, and I actually shared this DPP, the basics of it, and I said, you can do this at home. Start counting your calories and your fat grams. Start moving. The governor was saying, stay healthy at home, but my thing was, get healthy, especially in the middle of this pandemic. If you were to actually contract it, when it affects your lungs and you're already struggling, you know, with the extra weight, just like me carrying that extra 25 pounds, that was harder to me to breathe. So definitely, I think getting healthy right now is even more important. Make those choices.
And for the moment, with so many people in eastern Kentucky having the sort of underlying health issues like diabetes that could make COVID-19 even worse, Mary Beth says she's committed to keeping herself and her neighbors safe.
I do advocate the wearing of the mask. I know that's a very controversial issue, but 30, 40 minutes when I'm in the store of wearing the mask is not that difficult of a task for me to do if it's going to keep someone else healthy. I could be asymptomatic. I don't know that. You know, I it's not just about me. It's about everybody else out there around me.
For Eastern Standard and from Apple Shops WMMT, I'm Parker Hobson.
This story comes to us from the storytelling project Prevent Diabetes EKY, a collaboration between Apple Shop and the Kentucky Department of Public Health. The music performed by Glenn Jones and Laura Baird. Find more on the Diabetes Prevention Program online at preventdiabeteseky.org. Sharing big stories from small places we call home. That's how the producers of Middle of Everywhere describe this podcast series, being released biweekly and available for download on all podcast platforms. And joining us from member station WKMS in Murray, Kentucky, are the series co-creators, co-producers, and co-hosts, Ariel Lavery and Austin Carter.
Hello.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for joining us. And let's just get right to us. Tell us what Middle of Everywhere is all about.
Well, we kind of came up with this idea of thinking about the fact that the middle of the country gets somewhat disregarded in the news media that you hear from coastal cities and in the urban centers. And we wanted to create a show that maybe focused a little bit more on some of the voices that come from Middle America. And the show kind of evolved out of that inclination.
Ariel, Austin touched on it before, but maybe you could expand on why it's important to tell these stories about life in small towns and rural America.
Well, I feel like the country, especially now, actually has a curiosity and a need to hear from people from rural America. As Austin said, we don't often hear stories of people that are living in these towns or rural parts. We might hear more broad brushstrokes that get painted by people who fly in to get a picture of what rural America might look like without actually talking to the people that live there. You also see a lot of stories that come out of maybe some of the data that is projected in different polls and just different ways of looking at rural America that don't include individual voices. So we wanted to really focus in and zero in on some stories of individuals. You know, there's stories of heroism, there's stories of defeat and triumph, and we really want to give the picture of how diverse and eclectic rural America actually is these days.
Ariel, let's listen to something that you produced. Tell us what we're about to hear.
This is a story of a man who, when he moved back to his home state of Kentucky, he moved to Independence, Kentucky, wanted to get the same license plate that he had had in Ohio for 12 years, which read, "I'm God, I-M-G-O-D. And when he applied for that vanity plate in Kentucky, was denied. And he actually is a lifelong atheist. He's 82 years old. So you can imagine what the country looked like when he decided to pursue atheism at, I think he was 15 or 16. Hmm. And he decided to sue the state for denying his First Amendment rights to the I'm God plate. So the ACLU took up his case. It was in litigation for 4 years, and just this year he was awarded the license plate. But this story actually has a much bigger background for the implications for other people around the state. It has actually forced the state to withdraw a statute against religious implications or religious sayings on their plates, religious or anti-religious sayings. So it's quite an interesting story that this atheist has kind of brought forth, revealing what First Amendment rights look like on our license plates.
Okay, let's listen.
Well, I thought it was a matter of getting people to enter into a conversation about it. And they could tell me how they felt, and I could tell them how I felt. It gave me a chance to explain my position. But nobody asked me anything. They just totally ignore it. It's very few times have I had a comment on it.
But the few times he has had comments on it, they tend to just challenge him and say,
"Well, you're not God." And I'll say, "Well, I'll tell you what. I've got a $100 bill I've been carrying for 20 years for the first person that can prove I'm not God. Now, you go right ahead."
There was a story of a woman in Texas who challenged him.
"Well, I can't prove it, but I know you're not God." "Well, I'm not the God of the Bible. I'm the God of the dictionary. The American Heritage Dictionary has 6 definitions for God. And number 5 is a very handsome man. And my wife says I'm a very handsome man, and nobody argues with my wife."
Uh-huh. Yeah, he tells everybody that story.
And I still got the $100, so.
So that explains his philosophy behind the plate. But the story really takes off once he comes back to his home state of Kentucky.
You take on some stereotypes along the way in this series, and that's a subject, of course, that's near and dear to the hearts of many right here in our listening area of Eastern Kentucky. Tell us more about that.
You know, I've grown up in Kentucky my whole life, so I've been subject, as many folks in Eastern Kentucky probably are too, to the suggestions that people from Kentucky aren't as intelligent, or that they're all one political persuasion, or that they don't wear shoes or marry their cousins, or any number of damaging stereotypes that we hope to address in this show and inform outsiders of how ill-formed those conceptions are of what Kentucky actually is. You know, I think it would surprise some people in particular regarding the I'm God episode of that there would be, you know, outspoken atheists in a Bible Belt state like Kentucky. But the diversity that exists in rural America is something that we think really needs to be highlighted.
Okay, let's check out another of these stories. Austin, this is one of yours, Madstone Rabies. If you would set this one up for us.
So this episode is called The Mystical Ellis Madstone, and it is about this old healing tradition known as a Madstone. And this family that immigrated from England to the Virginia colony of Jamestown early on carried with them a stone which was believed to heal rabies and bites from poisonous animals. And so at this point in the episode, we've learned a little bit about the history of this stone, and we're going to find out more about why people in the past were so fearful of rabies.
Okay, let's listen.
My name is Monica Murphy, and I wrote Rabid, A Cultural History of the World's Most Diabolical Virus with my husband, Bill Wasik. People have been aware and worried about rabies going back further than we can possibly know. With the very first introduction of written language, people right away start writing about rabies. The Sumerian texts mention rabies and penalties for owners of dogs who rampage and bite others and expose them to rabies. So this has been a preoccupation of man throughout history, and one can presume prehistory, going back as far as dogs and people have been living together.
Wow, that's so interesting to consider rabies is this huge part of our history. But today we don't really experience it the same way. I mean, I kind of thought we had pretty much defeated rabies.
Well, thanks to Louis Pasteur, we do have a rabies vaccine, but even today, it's still a very dangerous threat in some parts of the world. And if you think about something recent like the coronavirus pandemic, which has resulted in death in the U.S. in around 5% or less of cases, Monica's description of what rabies is really is truly terrifying.
The disease itself really is devastating. It is virtually 100% fatal. It has the highest case fatality rate of any infectious disease, meaning once you have symptoms of rabies, you're going to die. And the death is not a pretty one. It is marked by hallucinations and convulsions and all sorts of miseries, not only for the sufferer, but for everyone around them. It's a horrible way to watch your loved one go. And especially because rabies disproportionately affects children. This has been just very upsetting to people throughout, you know, human history, and the focus of a lot of interest in how to prevent people from dying this terrible death.
Where can we find Middle of Everywhere podcasts?
You can find it at any app you get your podcasts at. You can also listen on our website at middleofeverywhere.org.
And folks can find us on social media on Instagram and Facebook at Middle of Everywhere Pod. And we'd love to interact with folks who have listened to episodes and have opinions or have things that they would like for us to dig into more as well.
Ariel Lavery, Austin Carter, co-creators, producers, and hosts of the podcast series Middle of Everywhere from WKMS at Murray State University in Murray, Kentucky. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Well, Thanksgiving is almost here, and out-of-control pandemic is already here. What do we do? WEKU's Wendy Barnett took the question to Dr. Donna Arnett, Dean of the College of Public Health at the University of Kentucky.
Donna, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
What are the risks of gathering this Thanksgiving in large groups?
Well, with the coronavirus peaking currently in Kentucky, it's really important that we take precautions in meeting with people outside our immediate family or in large gatherings.
Tell us what can happen when asymptomatic carriers get together in the kitchen to help prepare a meal, sit down at the table together, and watch a game together. What's going to come of that?
Well, as we know, there are many people who are asymptomatic. And so to no fault of their own, they can be spreading the virus. So it's really important to wear your mask when you're in person with other people and to stay socially distanced while you're wearing your mask. Now, if you're eating, if you can, it's best to eat outside so that the air circulation can blow away any virus particles that may be floating around the individual that is asymptomatic.
What is the latest information that we know about how this virus spreads from one person to another?
There seems to be what are called super spreaders. That is one individual who is diseased, who spreads it to many other people. These tend to happen in places like restaurants or weddings or funerals, where there could be singing going on or loud talking, like in bars. Mm-hmm. So it seems to be more important in those settings to maintain your mask wearing and your social distancing.
Are there risks from touching a serving utensil that an infected person just used to, say, ladle gravy into their turkey?
Well, certainly we know that the virus exists for some amount of time, although it is estimated that that's a really lower risk of transmission than the more common risk, which are either aerosolized particles of the virus in the air or direct droplets with the virus in the droplet itself.
What if you have some family members that are flying in from somewhere else? You know, a 14-day quarantine wouldn't make sense. I'm sure there's people that are going to be flying from out of state into the area to visit their family members. What would you suggest?
Right now, a lot of the state of Kentucky is in a red zone area, so it's highly probable that we're as bad as other places that people are coming from. That said, it's really important to be tested before you take off on a trip like that, particularly if you're flying. You don't want to expose other people to the virus, but also if you're visiting an elderly individual in your family or friend, it's really important to know that you don't carry the virus when you visit.
For that matter, do you think that everyone who does insist on gathering for the Thanksgiving holiday, do you think that they should be tested before and after they have their gatherings?
Well, certainly before the gathering would be really helpful. And the testing time is running a little bit shorter now. So ideally, you could find a place that could give you the result within 24 hours. And of course, you'd want to stay isolated away from other people while you await those test results so you're not getting out in the community and acquiring the infection after being tested.
Donna Arnett, Dean of the College of Public Health at the University of Kentucky. Donna, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That wraps this week's edition. Have a happy Thanksgiving, and we'll see you in a couple weeks. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.